Because Andy was dominating.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started, opening up the Committee on Judiciary. Thank you for being here. Today, we have a number of bills before us for public hearing and possible work session. I will tell you on some of the work session will not happen today because I have had requests at least on one bill to leave it open for possible use of the relating clause, which needs to be discussed. But what we're going to do is start off, since we have numerous representatives here that need to get back to their business, we're going to start off with House Bill 3198. And Mike?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3198 requires the justice and municipal courts to notify the Oregon State Police after they have entered convictions for a misdemeanor so that OSP may enter those convictions in LEDs pursuant to their rulemaking authority.
All right, great. Representative Nathanson, and then I also have Scott Winkles. Why don't you go ahead and come up too, Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13. Dozens of occupations in the private public sector require criminal background check, like home care workers, school employees, including teachers and bus drivers, medical professionals, like dentists, physicians, counselors, and even escrow agents. Those background checks protect all Oregonians. Think about the children, the seniors, the consumers, all of us. We expect those background checks to be thorough and rely on them. After digging deeper into the details of the process, I discovered that not all information from criminal convictions in Oregon is available on our state system. Some criminal convictions are through local courts, either municipal or justice courts, and not every court sends all data or even any data about convictions to the state system. We know that some local courts handle more than just traffic violations. They deal with crimes such as assault for, theft, and DUI. That means that not only is the conviction information missing for a complete background check, but it's also not available for law enforcement officers, judges, and other court officials who rely on that information. Oregon has more than 170 local courts, 141 municipal, and 32 justice courts. Those courts don't operate as an organized system. They don't report to the state circuit court system, and we don't have a way, an organized way, of knowing which ones send how much, if any, data to the state system. We have heard that some do. We also know that some don't. This bill requires local courts, justice and municipal courts, to send judgment and conviction data to the state justice system. If they already do, they don't have to do anything new or anything different. I have checked in with several law enforcement officers and their representatives, with state judges, the Oregon Association of Municipal Court Judges, the Association of Oregon Counties, the League of Oregon Cities, and my own municipal court judge, checking in with them about the purpose of the bill and the impact it might have on their operations. The League of Oregon Cities explains that it's not a significant impact, and as pointed out in testimony to the House Judiciary Committee, it's vital for district attorneys to know what a person's criminal record is. Judges, DAs, law enforcement officers, and persons authorized to do the background checks should have the full picture of convictions in front of them. So think about the home care workers, the children's advocates, the elder abuse task force, consumers, and even other employees in the workplace. I think it's important to close this gap in protecting the public. So I'd appreciate your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Scott, are you going to be quick? I'm going to ask, let's first do this because I know Representative Nathanson needs to go back. Are there any questions for her? All right, Scott.
For the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. We're appearing in support of this legislation. I spoke with Representative Nathanson about this bill some time ago, and we floated the concept with a number of our city recorders and bailiffs in the municipal courts, and we do not believe it. We believe that, A, this is something that should be taking place now, and, B, reporting of this data should not be a significant burden, according to the feedback we got from our members. It's also important that the municipal court gets this data. For instance, there are certain crimes that, if they're committed multiple times, can elevate to a felony, which means the local court should not be that case should be kicked to the circuit courts. For instance, a third DUI in 5 years, it's 5 years, is a felony, and so the local court would need to know that person's criminal history. Additionally, they would also want to know for purposes of sentencing and general public safety the totality of the history of the person that's in front of them. So we do support this legislation.
All right, thank you. Just for the record, the two courts that I prosecute in do actually report Eugene and Florence. And just make sure that they're on the right side here. Yes.
And so it is only Class A's. The other misdemeanors are not part of the reporting requirement, correct?
That's pretty much how it's been in the past. I know that both those courts have done that. And the reason for the A's is, Winkles said, there are counters and tickers for different things, and the B's and C's are not there yet. Any other questions, comments? Thank you very much. Is anyone else who wanted to testify on House Bill 3198? Not seeing anyone running up here. We're going to close the public hearing. And did we have all the paperwork?
Yep.
We'll open up a work session on House Bill 3198.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3198 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Close moves House Bill 3198 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair will carry 3198. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3198. And we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 3253A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3253A requires persons convicted of crimes in a court of the United States that required sex offender registration to also register in Oregon, even if the crime they were convicted of does not require registration in Oregon. Pertains to federal convictions, applies only to crimes committed after the passage of this act.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Olson, did you want to kick off the panel?
Yes,
please, sir.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative out of the Albany area. And just quickly with 3253, you're going to be getting a letter, but I'm going to read this to you. Basically what this bill does, the measure would ensure that Oregon does not inadvertently incentivize sex offenders moving into the jurisdiction of Oregon in order to avoid the sex registration requirements that they are sentenced under in a different state. This bill is prospective, and essentially the bill applies to offenders convicted of an offense or adjudicated for an act on or after the effective date of this act. Additionally, this bill would apply to the requirement under federal law as well. And I appreciate Vi Beatty from the Oregon State Police Sex Offender Registration is here too, should any questions surface. But Michael Slauson and also Aaron Knott are here too from the Department of Justice. They're part of the Internet Crimes Against Children, ICAC, organization. And they were the ones that supported it and felt that this was something that needed to be addressed. So I'll kind of stop there and let them finish up. There are going to be probably maybe one or two small amendments to this that will be considered, but just give you a heads up on that, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Aaron or Mike?
Sure. Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Department of Justice and the Attorney General. And we're here to help Representative Olson. He and Representative Conger convened a work group going into this session on ICAC issues, Internet crimes against children. That acronym refers back to a subdivision of the Department of Justice's Criminal Justice Division. And we got together a few times. This is one of several bills generated. The basic point of this is that if you are convicted of a crime in another state that would require you to register in that state and you move to Oregon, that registration requirement continues. So you can't use Oregon as a safe haven if it happens for one reason or another not to have an exact statutory analog to the crime for which you were convicted. But the much smarter and more knowledgeable gentleman is sitting to my left, so I'll go ahead and introduce him. This is Michael Slauson. He works in our Criminal Justice Division and was a key technical drafter of this proposal. So,
Michael.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Michael Slauson. I am an Assistant Attorney General in our Criminal Justice Division at the Department of Justice. What I wanted to testify about was just a little tweak we wanted to make to the current language. So to retain a provision of law that already existed that this modified slightly. So the situation arises in which somebody is commits a crime in their home state, but they're not required to register in their home state, but they move to Oregon, and they would be required to register here if they had committed their crime here. This changes that slightly. We want to retain that language, and we have amendment language that would do that, so somebody doesn't get to move here and avoid the registration requirement.
All right, questions? Senator Roblin.
So basically, right now, what it does is just takes those that come in with a conviction that in their own state would have required registration and says that registration carries over here, whether or not it would have in this state, which keeps it out. And what you're saying with the amendment would do is to take people who commit a crime in another state that it's not required to be a sex offender registered, but in this state that same crime would have required, will require it when they move here. Am I getting that right?
Chair Brzozinski, so Senator Roblin, that okay. You're correct. That's exactly okay. What we're doing. And also specifically dealing with, for the record, for federal crimes, because there's no federal registry. It's dependent on state law. So there are some federal sex crimes that don't line up element per element with our crimes. And so, therefore, people who commit federal crimes in our district, the District of Oregon, aren't required to register. Oh. So this covers that as well.
Okay. Very good.
All right. Any other? All right, thank you very much. And Representative Olson, I do have, let's say, a request from Mara Roach regarding the relating clause on this, so I'm assuming she's in contact
right,
with
right.
you.
Right, right. And that's one of the portions of the amendment, too, that we're okay. going to have that discussion with.
All right, I just want to put that on the record.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to testify today on House Bill 3253? Not seeing anyone, go ahead and close the public hearing on 3253. And which one?
2773.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2773. Mike?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2773 removes prior treatment disqualifier from diversion statute in cases of treatment order pursuant to a minor in possession of alcohol and possession of less than an ounce of marijuana.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser, state representative from Corvallis and Philomath. Thank you for scheduling a hearing on House Bill 2773. And I would just like to introduce you to my constituent, Joan Demarest, a local attorney who brought this bill forward. She's a nearby constituent.
Excellent.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Joan Demarest. I'm an attorney in Corvallis, Benton County, Oregon. And I was a deputy district attorney for Benton County for 8 years. And I provided legal advice to Oregon State University students for 3 years. And I've been in my own private practice doing criminal defense for 4 years. As you know, Oregon State University has a lot of students there. We also have a headquarters of the Oregon State Police right there on campus. A situation not unique to any college situation in Oregon is that students are there under age 21 and they're having contact with alcohol and they're getting in trouble for minor in possession of alcohol. Same thing with possession of less than an ounce of alcohol. A lot of courts across the state have developed diversion programs for first-time offenders where they plead guilty to the offense, they take some classes, they stay out of trouble for a year, and the case gets dismissed and they don't have the mandatory driver's license suspension. It's 1 year for the minor in possession of alcohol and 6 months for possession of less than an ounce of alcohol. Most of these students who enter the diversion programs do so with their violations, so there's no right to court-appointed counsel. They mostly enter the diversion programs without legal advice. Even when they do get legal advice, not all the time are they advised that if they enter the diversion program, they may not be allowed to do a DUII diversion for the next 15 years under the current law. Now, not every district attorney's office or prosecutor objects to people entering DUII diversion with a PCS less than an ounce or an MIP diversion in their 15-year history, but enough of them do that it is creating a problem. I've had clients who are in that situation, and then they find themselves faced with a DUII years later, and their only option, because they're not qualified to enter the DUI diversion, is to try to fight it every step of the way. And that means a DMV hearing, that means a motion to suppress, and that sometimes means a trial, which are very expensive to the state resources. I would submit to the panel that the PCS lesson announced and MIP are not situations that necessarily indicate that there's a significant problem with substance abuse. For both of those crimes, possession of any tiny, tiny amount, we're talking drops of beer in a can, we're talking flakes of marijuana residue in a smoking device or in a baggie, we're not talking people who necessarily have a serious substance abuse problem. This bill passed the House unanimously earlier this month, and it will save money to the state of Oregon, and it will make circumstances much better for the young people of Oregon. The way the law operates now is a serious disincentive to seeking early treatment that could nip addictive behavior in the bud. And just so you're aware, this does not necessarily mean that individuals with serious problems will be getting two stabs at a diversion treatment program. That was an issue that was brought up in the previous hearing on the other side on this issue. Also, while every court handles their diversion programs differently, the courts that I'm familiar with do not allow diversions in situations that are aggravated, situations where there's an extreme level of intoxication that requires hospitalization, or where somebody's vomiting, or where they run from law enforcement or give false information to law enforcement. Now, I can't say that every jurisdiction that offers diversions is like this, but I will say that it is. There are restrictions. Not everybody is allowed to do it. So, situations in Benton County where it looks like there is a serious issue with alcohol, they're not allowed into the diversion program to begin with on the MIP. So I urge you to vote yes, and I thank you for your time. And I'm happy to hear any questions.
I'm just shocked that there's underage drinking on college campuses.
I was surprised.
All right, so.
Especially Oregon State.
Joan, if you can go over that last statement. Perk my interest when you're saying some individuals are not being allowed into the diversion. Are you saying diversion for the violations, or are you saying they're being prohibited from doing diversion in the crime based on the level of intoxication?
Well, that is a basis for objection to DUII diversions, but that's not what I was talking about. What I'm talking about is for MIP diversions.
Okay.
If somebody is excessively intoxicated, many courts use that as a basis to deny the diversion.
Okay.
On the MIP.
And I'll put on the record that these type of programs that they're talking about that are for the violations are not the same programs that the diversions that someone would be going through a DUII. It could only be a half a day class. It could be just an informational type of awareness that what alcohol or marijuana could be involved in your life, as compared to going through a 6-week, 8-week, 12-week type of course and regiment. So there's a lot of difference there.
Yeah.
MIP diversion is much different from the adult.
It can, well, they're focusing on more what I call an awareness of abusing substances.
Okay.
It's not geared necessarily to the same program. Now, I do understand that there are some programs that the student could be referred to that would be very similar, if not the same, because some jurisdictions don't have the others, but the ones around universities, I know for Eugene, are not to the level that you would see if someone was going through a DUII diversion program. Any other questions or comments?
There is a difference, especially in college cases, because actually when I went to college, some minors actually consumed adult beverages too, so it's hard to believe. That was even at Willamette, I mean, you know.
All right.
Not me.
Confessions or anything else? All right. Thank you all very much. Is there anyone else who wants to testify today on House Bill 2773? Not seeing, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2773. And before we move it, I do want to check my notes. House Bill 2773.
Yeah, pretty narrow relating clause.
No, I was looking to see, some individuals actually are sending me notes regarding bills that are coming over, and okay. I'm just making sure I'm paying attention to those notes before we move something out.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2773 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Close moves House Bill 2773 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And would someone like to carry this one? Senator Cruz will be the carrier on Senate House Bill 2773.
Does that mean he's going to make a confession on the floor?
I think we've already covered that.
Okay. Probably not. But Representative Gelser has been shadowing me for about 3 days now, and I end up carrying her bills, so it's an amazing thing.
It's a force. All right. So with that, we'll close the work session on 2773, and we'll open up a House House Bill 3281 for a public hearing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3281 adds agents of the defense to the statutes that govern the rules of engagement with victims of crime.
All right, and I have Aaron up for this one, and that's all I have at this point.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, again, my name is Aaron Knott, Legislative Director for the Attorney General in the Department of Justice, here in support of House Bill 3281. We brought this bill before you in response to a Court of Appeals case called Johnson v. DPSST. Johnson was a defense investigator, and under the Victim's Bill of Rights, if a defense attorney calls up a crime victim, there are certain things they must do and certain things they can't do. Specifically, they have to provide their name, they have to say who they work for and why they're calling. Johnson, this investigator, basically did the opposite of that. He lied about who he was. He lied about who he worked for. At times, he even represented that he worked variably for the city or for law enforcement or for victims' rights. And the reason this case is called Johnson v. DPSST is because DPSST tried to strip him of his investigatory license, and this is the case that resulted. The Court of Appeals ultimately found defense attorneys can't call and lie about who they are, but right now their defense investigators can. So we are here in response to that Court of Appeals decision. Now, something I want to be very clear about, I think the defense bar was as scandalized by this as we were. I don't perceive this to be a widespread phenomenon that defense investigators are calling and making this sort of a fraudulent misrepresentation to crime victims. Nonetheless, this is a significant loophole that exists in the law right now. Fortunately, this is a very recent case. It just came down in November, so the loophole hasn't existed for long, and we'd like to close it now. So House Bill 3281 makes a few small changes. The big one is it simply establishes that defense agents are under the same obligations as defense attorneys. State your name, state who you work for. It also makes a few small tweaks in victims' rights generally. For example, right now you have the right to have a district attorney present with you. If you're interviewed by a defense investigator, this expands that to an assistant attorney general if it's a DOJ case, or a victim's advocate if you have one assigned to you. Also makes it clear that this applies in a post-conviction relief proceeding as well as a criminal case. So not a complicated bill, but a very important one. I'm available for questions.
Questions? Aaron, I have one question. Does the individual that's, let's say the investigator, have a duty to inform the victim or victim witness that they have the right to have either an assistant district attorney, a deputy AG, or a victim's right person?
Chair Przanski, my understanding is that ORS 135970, which was what will be the basis for this expansion, currently obligates a defense attorney to state their name, tell the victim that they aren't obligated to talk to them, and that they may have a district attorney present.
All right. Thank you. Just want that on the record. Anything else? All right. Thank you very much. Is anyone else who wants to testify today on House Bill 3281? Not seeing anyone running up. We'll close the public hearing on 3281. Open up a work session on House Bill 3281.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3281 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Close moves House Bill 3281 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And any volunteers to carry? Senator Roland. Be our carrier. We'll close the work session on 3281. Open up a public hearing for our last bill for today, House Bill 2542.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2542 creates a directive for Department of Transportation to revoke a license for 3 years where the defendant is convicted of failure to perform the duties of a driver to injured persons under ORS 811705, and the court notes on the record that the person sustained serious physical injury.
All right, and we have Christy Finney. Why don't you come up, Christy? And while she's coming up, is there anyone else who will want to testify on House Bill 2542? When you're ready.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name's Christy Finney. I'm from Vancouver, Washington. I'm the mother of a young man who was killed in Portland in a hit and run by a hit-and-run driver. And I've learned the hard way that we need to get tougher on this crime. In August of 2011, two young men were struck by an SUV traveling in the bike lane on Division. The vehicle first hit my son, Dustin, throwing him 175 feet over the head of 17-year-old Kevin, who was then also hit. The driver took off as if nothing happened, according to witnesses. Dustin died at the scene, and Kevin had minor injuries. An 18-year-old male caught within the hour and with a blood alcohol level of 0.169 3 hours after the crash eventually pleaded guilty to criminally negligent homicide, felony hit and run, DUII, and vehicular assault of a bicyclist. He's serving 5 years in prison with a possible 20% time off for good behavior. Our family took the guilty plea rather than go to trial for manslaughter because the district attorney felt that the case wasn't strong enough to win a conviction. No one had seen the driver. The defendant was covered in glass. His own blood was in the vehicle. His fingerprints were on the door handle. And his girlfriend admitted she gave him the car to drive, but no one could testify that they saw him behind the wheel. What I've learned since my son's death is that when one person hits another and then makes the decision to leave that person on the road like garbage, uncaring of their degree of injury, whether death, traumatic brain injury, or a scraped knee, the driver has stacked the legal deck in their own favor. Leaving is often the best thing that they can do for themselves. Sometimes they get away with their crime entirely. Sometimes they turn themselves in later after they've had time to sober up or seek legal representation. Sometimes they're caught despite their best efforts to run, but even then, leaving the scene was somehow to their benefit, as in my case. In my research of hit-and-run crashes, I've rarely, if ever, seen a driver who didn't have some other issue than just leaving the scene. There was a reason they left, and it wasn't just I was afraid or I didn't know I hit anybody. These drivers were impaired by drugs or alcohol. They were using their phone. They were driving while suspended or revoked. They had previous reckless driving convictions. They had outstanding warrants, or they were possibly in the commission of another crime, such as stealing a vehicle. A person who leaves the scene of a crash, especially an injury crash, is not innocent. They are selfish and uncaring. What if by staying they could have prevented a death or at least seriousness of injury? What if by staying they could have prevented a second or third vehicle from further hurting the victim? What if they could have comforted a critically injured person instead of leaving them to die or suffer alone? The cry of every mother of every injured person in a hit and run is, how could someone do that and then leave my child alone on the road like that? We never are able to look at people the same again. We no longer trust anybody. We know it can happen to us, and we wonder when it will happen again. Every new hit and run is just another blow. During the sentencing in my son's case, the consequence that appeared to most upset the young man who killed him was that he lost his driver's license for life. So I'm here in support of House Bill 2542. I realize that my son was killed, and this bill is not for death. But I believe that the consequences need to be tougher for those who just injure. This is a devastation that lingers on. Hit and run is serious, and I ask you to please get serious about the consequences. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions. I do want to put a couple of things on the record, and Mike, help me out here. So If a person, this is what my memory is, that if someone gets a lifetime suspension, that's actually a 10-year suspension, and then their individual becomes eligible. It doesn't mean they're going to get their license back. So I want to make certain everyone on the committee understands that when you hear that term, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's totally for life. And then this bill here will deal with felony hit and run as compared to property damage. And so there would be no difference on the property damage if they're convicted. It's 1 year. And felony right now, is it what, 5 years or 3 years?
So right now, the way the law is if there's a death involved in the felony hit and run, then it's a 5-year suspension. If there's no death, then it's just a 1-year suspension.
Okay.
This would say if there's serious physical injury, then there would be a 3-year suspension, essentially striking a middle ground between nothing and death.
Having the bridge.
Yeah.
So basically we maintain 1 year for property, and then where there is a injury that qualifies, it can go 3 years or it would be 5 years.
That's right.
All right. Any other comments or questions? I want to thank you very much for coming forward and taking the time to bring this to us. I know it's not easy for anyone to come forward and tell their story, but it's unfortunately these type of instances that actually bring it to our attention so we can consider doing something different. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2542 and go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2542.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2542 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Close moves House Bill 2542 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. I think the chair is going to carry this one regarding the technicalness of the various levels if there's any questions on the floor. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 2542. And I believe that takes care of everything. We're scheduled to be here tomorrow at 8:30, and we're adjourned until then. Thank you.
When you have a 9:30.